Hi, it's TJ Murphy, Editor-in-Chief of Lava Magazine, and today our guest is the recently crowned Ironman Boulder champion operating on his home turf this past weekend. Welcome to our show again, Tim O'Donnell. Tim, congratulations on a strong race, a great race, and a nice victory.
Thanks, TJ. Yeah, it's always, it's nice to be back on the show, and especially since it means I did well.
Yeah, I actually, I'm proud of the fact that I was able to report that you were doing Ironman Boulder in the first place. You kind of, I think you might have been the first to try it. Yep. I don't know if you told that about. So, it's great to get the end story here. And, you put together a strong across the board effort for the win, a 49.20 swim, 4:24.25 on the bike, and a 2:53.55 run, an 8:13.30 overall time. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to be there, but, so that gives me the fun of being able to ask you about how the day went for you, which I know is like always the standard first question you get from a journalist with a notebook after the race, because it's hard to, watch some of these things. But the best story is how it really went for you and how you describe it to others.
Yeah, I mean, I think it actually, rarely do races go according to your race plan.
Yeah.
But Boulder for me was one of those days where everything actually did kind of go pretty well according to plan. I was really excited to do the race. I love racing up here in Boulder. I've done Boulder Peak, so many times, and I've done the half, and I just know that I just get excited and do well up here. So I just made an effort to really get on top of the race right away with the swim, and was able to get a gap on, guys like Matt Charbot and Jared Shoemaker. Yeah. About halfway through the swim, and gave myself about a minute out of the water. And I really wanted to do the race on my own and just get in my own rhythm and really not worry about anybody else. And I wasn't sure if that was going to happen in the swim or if I was going to have to try to make that happen on the bike. And, I was lucky I got that little gap, and that gave me some time to kind of ease into the bike, each lap of the 3-lap bike course. So, yeah.
And, tell me a little bit, you mentioned that you went in with a plan. So how does that work for you? I'm just imagining that means you're setting certain targets in terms of time intervals, or are you looking at wattage? How does that kind of work for you in terms of leveraging off of competitors? What are your key sort of focus points?
Yeah, first and foremost, I was really just aiming to win the race. It's hard to, you want to go fast, you want to break 8 hours, all that stuff. But when you're racing at altitude, it's just kind of, it's an X factor.
Right.
A win's a win, right? Like if I won Kona, right. If I went 9:15 and won Kona because of some crazy conditions or something, I still wouldn't care. Like, I'd still be the champion, right?
Yeah.
So, it's really just strategizing, the race against the other competitors was my primary goal. And then once I was able to kind of, set that up and then worry about, my heart rate and things like that, I do log my power, but I don't follow it in the race. I go more off a heart rate, and that's kind of my physiological guide. So, yep,
Mark. Yeah, that's interesting. And and I know you've worked with your friend Mark Allen, 6-time Hawaii Ironman champion. You've actually kind of triggered a memory for me. I recall reading about one of the differences, at least this is what was reported between Dave and Mark, was that Mark was kind of a Phil Maffetone guy, and he was definitely a heart rate guy along with Mike Pigg, and that Dave used heart rate for sure in his training, but on race day he wouldn't wear a watch, maybe even he would just race. And so obviously those things, whatever works best for you is what works best for you, but obviously I just have to think that okay, your 4:24 bike, that's a remarkable time, and I know you've obviously spent a lot of time training on those roads and racing, like you mentioned Pikes Peak and all. But how did you set up your trek, and how did you plan and train for that to deliver such a great split?
Yeah, we actually, everybody that did Boulder, they did a sort of an Ironman Plus, because it's actually a 114-mile bike course.
Lovely. So, lovely.
Yeah, I knew in advance, but I know a lot of people were they were seeing 112 miles come up on their on their Garmin, and they're like, still not even close to Boulder High School, and they're like, what is going on? Did I go the wrong way?
So do I have altitude sickness? I must have altitude sickness.
Yeah, I'm getting dizzy, I'm seeing stars. But so I was at 4:20 at 112 miles, which I was pretty happy with. Obviously there's a little with racing up high, there's a little with difference in air pressure, it's a little faster riding, but then of course you have the fact that your body is working a lot harder. So Yeah, I mean, I was really happy with being able to do that. And I was sort of experimenting a little bit with my setup on my speed concept. Mm-hmm. You know, I've raced really well in Kona the last 2 years riding 165 cranks.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to squeeze a little bit longer of a crank out and see how I felt. And so I rode 1675s and I've been training on it, obviously, but I felt a little uncoordinated on that first lap of the bike.
Huh.
But yeah, second two laps, I felt like I started to get my rhythm going. And it's amazing. I mean, 2.5 millimeters is like,
no kidding.
It's not much at all, right? But like when your body knows something, you know, when you're that finely tuned, it does make, I guess, make that difference, you know? So,
well, so one of those things, like, I'm sure you probably had a little bit of anxiety about making that change just because, as you sort of indicated, these motor patterns are pretty fine tuned. And I recall 1 year, all my memories, but Peter Reed decided to, the day before the race, he decided to raise his seat like a couple millimeters, maybe a centimeter, and it destroyed him. He just cramped up and he was just using, you know, just that slight little bit of difference But it sounds like you actually, it was the right choice, and the different crank length, you found the right groove.
Yeah. So, you know, you're always trying to fine tune your position and see what works for your body. And I went to that shorter crank because I have a little bit of a bone impingement in my hip. So when you're riding that longer crank, it, you know, kind of jams up your hip, and you can get a lot of issues with all those hip muscles and hip flexors and psoas and all that stuff. So, you know, we went to the shorter crank, and that really relieved a lot of that,
no kidding,
you know, that pressure up in my hip. And seem to really ride really well with it, but I'm always kind of wondering, you know, how does it affect my run? It seems like guys with the longer levers, I've been trying to find data on this. I haven't seen any studies or anything, but it seems like that, you know, for some reason you run a little bit better off of that longer crank. So I guess I'm still trying to figure that out a bit, but yeah, I felt good running off of the 1675s, which is maybe a good sign.
That's a good sign. Yeah. And along those lines, typically any of us that race an Ironman, we have kind of those ups and downs. Were there any particular parts of the race where you were wondering if, it sounds like you mentioned at the outset here that it went according to plan. Did you have any hiccups at all, or was it pretty smooth?
I don't think anytime you race for 8 hours plus, I don't think it's ever going to be
right,
smooth the whole way.
Right.
And I had a couple of rough patches on the run, which I'm like, oh man, I feel horrible. And I was like really upset, but I'm like, actually, it's pretty late in the race to be, you know, starting to have a couple dark patches. But so on the bike, I, you know, talking to Mark, he, did, I think it's called Power Man, the Zoffinger course.
Sure. Tough duathlon.
Yeah. And it's a 3-lap course. And he said he would race, the best he ever ran at that race is when he like basically built into the bike each lap, got faster and faster. And he said, lost time to the field on the first lap, then he stayed even, and then by the third lap he ton of time into everybody, and then
so sort you know, of a, well. Kind of a negative split situation.
Right, yeah. So I kind of made that approach on the bike, and the first lap I was about, you know, a minute 30 ahead of Matt Charbot, who was in second at the time, and then after two laps it was up to 3 minutes, and then going into T2 it was like 6:40. So, you know, I was able to, you know, to build into that. And but in your head, you want to be just like crushing the race, and then you're hearing the time splits at the start, and you're not really doing any damage, and that gets in your head a little bit. But you know, luckily, I had enough patience to just stick to the plan and let the race build in my favor.
You know, one of the interesting things I think that someone like yourself, you know, the top pro ranks have to kind of calibrate and deal with, those that are focused on Ironman length racing, is okay, it's June. And you're in there to win. You're racing to win. At the same time, you know, if you don't have to, you don't want to blow yourself to pieces. Do you make certain choices? Like, I'm kind of leading you on here with my question. But, like, I would think, based on my own experience, that in that case, for example, I would use more of a lightweight trainer for the marathon, or even something heavier, just to like reduce a little bit of the muscle damage. But if I'm really, if this is my Olympics, this is my chance to win the Hawaii Ironman or win an Ironman, you know, I would go with the 5-ounce sort of racer, maybe.
Right.
I probably wouldn't do that. I certainly wouldn't do that anymore. But back in my trepid youth. But I'm wondering, what did you do in that, for example, just like in terms of the kind of shoes you run in,
right,
to go for speed versus mitigating damage?
So I've had one experience running a marathon on concrete, and it was 2011 at Ironman Texas, the first year they had that race. And that was my first Ironman, actually. And first Ironman, I was, you know, wanted to run really fast, and I wore a really light race flat, like you said, like that 5 ounce race flat. And I ran well, but that was the rest of my season. I was done.
Your calves blew up.
Like, right? But I learned a lot in my old age, and I've great new partners that I didn't have in 2011 with Hoka. So yeah. I wore the Hoka's Tracer shoe, which is 7 ounces, a fast shoe and perfect cushioning for concrete. So that shoe really played really well into my game plan in terms of having the speed with the proper support and cushioning.
Yeah, you know, we're in this age of the engineering on some of the shoes out now. I think Hoka is a great example, obviously, but I recently got a pair of Salomons, and I'm like, they look cushioned, they feel very cushioned, yet they still register like a very lightweight. I find that it's a wonderful thing to have. They're not like 16 ounce shoes, and yet you're still getting some great protection.
Right. Yeah. And you look at even like the marathon guy runners, the guys that weigh a lot less than I do, probably like 2/3 of my body weight. They're all running in more cushion too now, you know?
Sure.
It's like, well, those guys, if those guys want more padding, then we can.
Yeah, those guys that weigh what, someone like you and I probably weighed in ninth grade, eighth grade.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Seventh grade.
Those guys might legally need car seats. I don't know if they're ways they weigh in.
Yeah. And another interesting area I'd love to get your insight on, and obviously whatever you planned on worked for you, but there's so many variables in an Ironman with nutrition, and then you had, sometimes you might have, you know, extremes like heat and humidity, which, you know, for example, Kona, but here, and I know that you essentially live at altitude, but still it's an altitude race. And I think hydration might be calibrated differently. Maybe there's other things. Can you talk a little bit about how you experimented, planned, and how your game plan went for you in the nutrition front?
You're absolutely right about hydration up at altitude. With the dryness, you don't, it's not like Kona where you're just dripping all over yourself and realizing how much water you're losing. You know, here, it evaporates so quickly that you kind of maybe lose track. But, you know, obviously, we lucked out. It wasn't as hot as it was even the day before up here. I mean, we had some overcast. So, I felt like hydration wise, everything was, you know, pretty easy to do with a bottle at every aid station, but I've been really working on balancing, nutrition-wise, balancing my forms of carbohydrates in terms of, glucose, fructose, mixes, and things like that. So I've really been pushing towards more of a 2-to-1 ratio. So, you know, two grams of glucose per gram of fructose, you know, about 9 grams an hour on the bike. And that seemed to really work pretty well for me.
Oh, that's great. And I have to ask, it must have been kind of a dream to like win a big race in, which is essentially your hometown now. I mean, I know you grew up on the East Coast, but that must have been pretty fun. And obviously my wife was there to celebrate with you at the finish line. Just did you get to really enjoy this one?
I did. Yeah. It seems to be so much more special when you're in your hometown and you get to share it with everybody. You know, obviously we're having Rennie there. And my parents flew out from Pennsylvania to come watch, which is the only second full Ironman they've come out to watch. They came out to Kona my first year, and I DNF'd. I got sick before the race. Oh. And so they thought they were like the curse. So they never showed up to another Ironman, and I had to like force them to come. I'm like, just come, trust me, come. And then, you know, having them at the finish line with Rennie, and you know, they've seen me race other races, but Ironman, the stage of Ironman is for long course racing. It's the epitome of the sport. So I think they were just kind of wowed as well, you know, the crowd and Mike Riley there and all that good stuff. But, you know, on top of that, we have so much great support here in town.
Sure.
With our strength coach, Aaron Carson, and Rally Sport, or the guys at Colorado Multisport that work on our bikes. And there's so many people in this town that allow us to do what we do well. And we couldn't be here without their support. So, you know, it's one thing for them to be watching online and us do well at a race, but, you know, for them to be here and for us to be able to share that with them and honor them and all that they do to support us. You know, it's important for us to have that experience and be able to share it with all them.
Oh, that's wonderful. And now they have to come to all of your races.
I know, obviously. Right?
I just want to share, this kind of loops back to our previous conversation a couple months ago, but I was asking you nutrition-related questions, and there'll be a link to that previous podcast in the show notes, but I was asking you about coffee, because I know that Mark Allen has had specific chunks of advice on how to use coffee for top performance. But you'd mentioned how you're very careful with coffee in general because you don't want to be addicted to it. And you were, at the time, I didn't mention this or admit this, I'm total coffee addict. And then, like, about the next day or the next week, I was reading one of Mep Kafleski's books, because I was preparing to interview him before the Boston Marathon. And in it, he's got this thing about how he said the almost exact same thing you did. I might have a cup of coffee here and there, but whatever I do, I just won't. So I'm like, well, that's just the writing on the wall. So I went through this this week of absolute detox, massive crash. but I'm happy to say you inspired me to let it go. And I got to say, I feel a lot better. So
awesome.
There you go.
That's great to hear. Yeah. did you have the headaches and everything that week?
The funny thing was, my wife, she drinks a little bit of coffee, but she knew that I was drinking too much. And that weekend, I started on a Saturday morning. And I think Sunday, I didn't really get the headaches, but I really felt off. And she just said to me at some point in the afternoon, is there something wrong with you? And I'm like, well, you know, I don't have the shakes or anything here, but I I couldn't put thoughts together in my head.
Right, so. Yeah, you're just not connecting the same. Yeah,
yeah, but some sort of neurotransmitter thing. So I had about 4 days of that. But anyway, I have to thank you for that personally. And one more question, and we're going to take a little break and then come back to talk with one of your sponsors that I'm very curious to talk about. But I just want to, this final question. So, great Ironman Boulder, and I'm sure you're enjoying the week, being able to just not worry about training and just focusing on recovery. But I imagine that you also do kind of, you know, you're a pretty determined guy and very analytical. Do you kind of do a postmortem on it and kind of see like what weaknesses you might have spotted out there that you might be able to capitalize and turn into strengths, things that you want to tweak in the coming months? Do you do that sort of a process after a big race?
Absolutely. I think you need to do it that first couple of days, just write down your thoughts and while everything's fresh and before you start to either, you know, kind of lose some of those thoughts or you start to sugarcoat them a little bit and think, oh yeah, well, it really wasn't that big of a deal, whatever, you know, little hiccup that you want to address. But, yeah, I mean, I was even just chatting with Mark yesterday, looking over my Garmin files and my heart rate and things like that and trying to kind of pull that data off and see, you know, how we use that to perform well in Kona.
That's great. And so before we take our little break, I just want to mention some of Tim's sponsors here. Sponsors are what help our pro triathletes stay in business and keep doing what they're doing. But Trek, Cliff, Hoka 1-1, Castelli, Garmin, Aquasphere, Smith, and a number of others. You can find them all on timothyodonnell.com. And then as a lead into our next chunk here, he's also, Tim, you're also working with Halo Neuroscience, which is a relatively new company. And I've been very fascinated with their technology and had a chance to try it out. As I sort of mentioned, we were preparing for this talk. I'm not 100% clear on how a triathlete can use this sort of tech to improve performance. And so I'm kind of excited to hear what you and then the CEO of Halo Neuro is going to be joining us to chat. But so we'll take a quick break here and be right back. Okay, we're back on the Lava Magazine podcast, and along with a recent, our 2017 Ironman Boulder champion, Tim O'Donnell, we also have Daniel Chow, who is the CEO of Halo Neuroscience. And Daniel, welcome to the podcast, and good to chat with you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and a little background on my part, I kind of, in my work for Lava and magazines like Outside Magazine, one of the territories that I'm really interested in is some of these new ideas that are coming out. And oddly enough, Dan, I was just telling Tim about how he had inspired me to go off coffee because I needed to take better care of my neurotransmitters. And here we have Halo Neuroscience, which we had an article in Lava, which will be linked to in the show notes about what I learned about it in trying it and interviewing you then. But why don't you, if you don't mind, could you describe for triathletes. Just a little background on Halo Neuroscience and Halo Neuro and what it is and what the outcome of using it as a training device can be.
Yeah, so the company is called Halo Neuroscience, and we are a neurotechnology company. My background is in medicine, so I went to Stanford for medical school and also got a master's in neuroscience there. And you know, specifically, my professional life is focused on using electricity to interact with the brain, you know, first for medical purposes, my last company. But for this company, we took a different twist. Like, we saw an opportunity to take advantage of some science that had been developed. This goes back to the 2003-2004 timeframe, where some scientists had figured out how to use a form of brain stimulation that can induce these temporary states of hyperlearning. So, you know, since that time, there have been 2,000 papers really solidifying the science in this area. Mm-hmm. My co-founder and I couldn't help but to notice this explosion in evidence around this field. So we wanted to come around and give, you know, just about anyone access to this technology in building it into a device that's simple and easy enough for just about anybody. So our first application is in sports. So the idea here is, let's stimulate this special part of the brain called the motor cortex, this part of the brain that controls movement in our bodies. Let's induce a temporary state of hyperlearning in that part of the brain. And then we do our athletic training. Like, what can happen then? You know, a big part of our athleticism is, you know, certainly it's our muscles and our heart for endurance, certainly for Tim. But what about the brain's role in athletic performance? Like, you know, that's arguably even, that might be the biggest chunk of athletic performance that makes us great athletes. And we haven't really been thinking about it.
Yeah. And this is, as you mentioned, there's a lot of solid research out there building to this. And if I recall correctly, some of your earlier work was with kind of a non-invasive way and non-drug way to help an epileptic, for example, prevent seizures. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So that, my last company called NeuroPace, and it actually was an invasive device. So we're talking about 3 hours of neurosurgery to have the equipment installed in someone's head. Yeah. So what we wanted to do with Halo is make it such that it's non-invasive. Like, you know, what could happen if you took the surgery out of the equation and yet you could still benefit from neurostimulation?
Yeah. And to give the listener kind of the image, they look like a really cool pair of headphones. And perhaps if I can jump to Tim for a little bit, you know, as I've come to know you, as a journalist and a fan of the sport, as I mentioned earlier, you're a very driven guy who's looking for new opportunities to eke out more levels of performance. How did you find out about Halo Neuroscience, and was that something that you've had some knowledge of in this area of hyperlearning and neurostimulation? And what was sort of your process in trying it out and using it to your advantage?
Yeah, so, I mean, at this level in the sport, it's, you know, little marginal gains that are going to really get you to the top of the podium. You know, all of us are pretty much training, you know, 30, 40 hours a week and doing pretty similar sessions. And, you know, we've all, in terms of training and fitness, are kind of maxed out. So it's, all right, well, you know, how do you make other improvements? How do you get other advantages over your competitors? And so, you know, that's, you're always looking for good methods to become a better athlete. And I actually saw an article about this probably last year, and it really piqued my interest, and I started researching a little bit more online. And just happenstance, like the next week, my manager, you know, he emails me and is like, "Hey, I want to connect you with Halo." And I'm like, "Are you serious?" "Yes, please. Let's do this. I want to see how this works." So I was able to start my early season training in January in Australia. Rittany and I always head down to Australia for January, February, part of March. And I was able to start training with the system, particularly on the trainer for my hard bike sessions, my strength sessions in the gym, and all my quality running. And running is really what I'm working on right now, because that's, for me, that's the final piece of the puzzle that really nailed to win that little race we all like to do in October. And, you know, just it fit really well into my quality run programs, doing drills before, stride outs before, and then the start of the main session. And I've been incredibly happy with the whole process, and in all honesty, the ease of the process. And that's
right.
That's really, really where you have to balance, because, you know, you're doing so much training. There's so many things you can do. It has to be easy. You know, you have to want to be able to do it. You don't want to have to, you know, be struggling, be like, "Oh man, I got to do this, you know, before a session, and you, because you're going to end up not doing it. So that was the
I totally concur with that. And I think that's one of the things I wrote in my review of Halo is that, you know, there's so many different, and every day there's a new technology out there. And if it takes me more than 15 minutes to kind of like set up and try and make use of it, then I'm probably not going to use it. But if it's simple enough to like just make it part of your warm up and then you're good to go. Like with the running drills, and to sort of dial in the outcome you're seeking, is that a thing where, okay, so your ultimate goal is to improve your running form and you're using the Halo to kind of just increase better coordination, better motor patterns, more muscles firing? Is that the kind of thing? Or is it to just, because you're trying to learn or improve your form, you're using this hyper learning to kind of like add a little oomph to that?
Yeah, I mean, I can let Dan maybe talk more about the science behind it, but for me, it's, all right, well, we're a very repetitive sport, right? And especially when you get into Ironman training, it's, you're practicing what you want to do, and you want to make sure you're practicing the right stuff. So if I can enhance, if I can stimulate, you know, my proper form, my proper cadence, things right, like okay. that, you know, that's going to bring me a big advantage.
Yeah. Does that sound about right to you, Dan?
Yeah, you know, that's exactly right. And I'll just add to it a little bit. You know, we get this question a lot. It's like, you know, how does neurostimulation and hyperlearning play into endurance sports? Because it is very repetitive. And, you know, I would argue that being a great endurance athlete is a skill that is vastly underappreciated. What Tim is great at is this skill of biomechanical efficiency. Like if Tim is 1% more efficient than, you know, the rest of his competitors, he just won. So how can we use motor learning such that Tim can run, swim, bike in the most biomechanically efficient way possible? And, you know, I think that's what we help him do. There's something that you learn, say, for example, in really hard intervals on a trainer. Like, let's say we put, you know, Tim on 400 watts for a couple of minutes. You know, what he's learning to do in those 2 minutes of pain is he's trying to figure out a way to get to this other side of the interval in the best shape, in the least amount of pain possible. And what that amounts to is just learning to be efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, what if we could help with that? Like, what if we could help solidify that pedal stroke or that running cadence that, you know, Tim is most comfortable at, most efficient at, and just helped him groove that into his brain so that he can tap into it on race day.
Dan hit the nail on the head in terms of efficiency, and Ironman is a game of efficiency. The most efficient guy wins, especially in the heat and humidity of Kona. And obviously, you know, I work with Mark Allen, who with his heart rate training, that's what heart rate training comes down to, becoming more efficient. You know, over 8 hour race, you're not going to be able to ingest enough carbohydrates to run off of. You have to be efficient enough to be burning fat and to be using stored fuel sources. So,
sure.
You know, with Halo, if I am more efficient, if my heart rate's lower, if I'm burning less calories, I'm going to be racing much better, you know, the back half of the marathon when everybody's starting to hit empty.
You know, one of the reasons that I became more and more interested in this, and it's ultimately, this is a question for, I'm curious at some of the areas that Daniel and his team have looked at, but in doing the reading on neurostimulation, I came across fairly recent research by a PhD named Dustin Grooms. He's got a PhD in neuroscience and biomechanics out of Ohio State, and his background was before he went and got his PhD, he had been a trainer with Cincinnati Bengals, I believe, and he'd actually seen years ago Carson Palmer after he'd had this big, massive knee injury and this entire team and millions of dollars being applied toward getting him back to where he could play again. And he was seeing, speaking of the word efficiency, here was all this money and all of this expertise, whatever tool was available at that time to help this guy get so that his right leg felt like it was his right leg again and could, and all the muscles were firing and his knee could be stable. And they didn't do it, not within a year anyways. And so Grooms has done some fascinating research in like looking at things like joint injuries and ACL reconstructions as not just, you know, typically we treat the joint, You know, you go to the standard physical therapist is just going to look at the tissues around the joint and try and get you stronger and things like that. But he looked at it as a brain problem. He's like, well, you know what? Whether you've injured your knee or you've had your had a below the knee amputation, you lose. Apparently, we just lose the ability to fire muscles for whatever reason. And so he's looking at it, and his research team looked at it. Well, what if we can work this from the other end of the spectrum here and just get the brain working better on these areas? So they're playing around with things like, you know, doing one-legged squats while you're wearing the strobe headset and things like that. So it made me think of Halo. And I don't know, does that sound like a possible application to you, Daniel? Because I think, and I'm speaking for sort of the age group or crowd out there, so many of us who haven't done what we probably should have done in terms of good mobility work and good strength work and good running form work and all that, we kind of, maybe we have one side of our body that's just not firing as well as the other. And I got to say, we see this at the world-class level too. Like, I know that Dave Scott worked with Craig Alexander a lot on the fact that one of the best runners in the world of triathlon, and he couldn't get his right hip to fire like his left hip. Does that sound like a possible application for Halo neuroscience?
Yeah, for definitely. So in the rehab process, the final mile is often the longest, I guess, just like in triathlon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some reasons for that, and a lot of them are neurologic in origin. So, you know, after an injury, there's a necessary period of disuse, and this is okay. Like the joint is injured, it's angry, it's inflamed, maybe there was surgery, so you need to rest that joint. You could see the atrophy that happens in the musculature almost immediately. Like within a week of disuse, you could just literally look at your quads and tell that they are smaller than the unaffected side.
Mm-hmm.
What you can't see is the atrophy that happens in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's, and this is adaptive. Like evolution has built itself such that this is usually a good thing. Like if you're not using a portion of your brain, the neighboring brain areas say, oh, well, you know, if you don't mind, I'm just going to move into your area. Since you're not being active, I'm going to just take over.
Hmm.
And most of the time that makes sense. But what the brain doesn't realize is that after 3 months, you know, it's go time for that joint. And we want that part of the brain back. And often it just never has a chance to catch up and become or overtake that same amount of territory that it used to have.
Wow.
So what if we paired physical therapy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if we helped, you know, athletes like Carson Palmer with that final mile of rehabilitation so that they can get back onto the field? You know, it's about pairing physical therapy with neurostimulation, induce these temporary states of hyperlearning, just like the way Tim uses it in his training.
Mm-hmm.
Like applied to a physical therapy model, it's about rebuilding proper movement patterns, like getting that part of the brain like back to where it used to be so that it could fire, you know, let's say it's an ACL. It's like, let's get that VMO firing again.
Right.
How can we wake up that muscle? Now, you could do as much muscle stim as you want, but if you don't wake up that part of the brain that controls that muscle, you'll never be able to do it by yourself, right? You can't compete with a muscle stimulator on your VMO.
You know, I just have to say that, you know, I'm pledging right now to do more riding in this area because in one of my reporting jobs a few years ago, I actually went and worked on a running shoe sales floor in Palo Alto, speaking of the Stanford area. It was in Menlo Park. You're probably familiar with it, Daniel. This Fleet Feet I worked at, I did it. It was a story for Runner's World, and it was kind of a story about running shoe commerce and retail running shoe stores. But what was remarkable to me was that I'd say one out of three people that walked in that store was the former runner type. Like, I can't run anymore because my knee just stopped working. And I had a knee surgery back in 1979, and everything you just said resonates with me because I've never was able to get it up to 100%, maybe 80% at best, you know? So that's fascinating territory. And to loop back to just the performance side of this, Tim, is this something that you mentioned running form, but it also sounds like this would be a interesting application like before a swimming workout, something like that. Have you tried that at all?
Yeah, I have. So for me, I do a lot of stretch cords before I swim. So that's the no-brainer for me in terms of using the system. But so my brother-in-law and sister actually own a U.S. club swim team in West Hartford, Connecticut. And they saw, I think, the press release a couple weeks ago when we announced our partnership. And they're like, we need to get one for the team because they do so much dry land on the Vasta trainers, which if anybody's not familiar with the Vasta trainer, it puts you in that horizontal position with a moving bench where you can, you know, you mimic your swim stroke, work on technique, obviously, that, and, you know, work interactively with the coach during that session where you can, you know, use the neurostimulation and have that feedback with your coach in terms of form that when you're not in the water, obviously you can't communicate as well. So they're really excited to incorporate this system into their team's training program.
Well, that's exciting stuff. And I hope we can kind of continue this conversation. I'm not sure if we described this for listeners, but this is how, well, you know, we have Daniel online. How do you suggest someone, what's the basic protocol for putting your technology to use before a workout? And I could even say a race.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the technology is mainly designed as a training tool. Like we see the athletes using it for the days, weeks, months, these countless thankless hours before your race day as being the way to get the most out of the technology. But to the extent that you can learn from race day, you know, there's an application there as well. But, you know, from a workflow perspective, it's about putting on the headset for 20 minutes before your workout. And, you know, we use that set of instructions because it's all encompassing. It works for all sports. Mm-hmm. But if your sport is conducive, like if the training of your sport is conducive to having something on your head while you're doing it, then by all means, like I'd love to hear from Tim, you know, like let's say you're about to jump on the trainer, you know, you're not outside, so you don't need a helmet. Like, you know, why not just start your trainer session with neurostimulation? And that way you get 80 minutes of hyperlearning rather than just 60.
And I find doing my quality workouts on the trainer has always been the most effective for me. So it works perfectly into those sessions.
Well, thank you so much, guys, for chatting about this. The website, Daniel, it's at haloneuroscience.com. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's haloneuro.com. I think Halo Neuroscience also works, but Halo Neuro is like less typing.
Right on. And I'll have a link to the show notes. But Tim, thank you so much for sharing some insight on this.
Of course.
A lot of new technologies out there that I think we need help sorting through, but I think there's a role there with this one. And just to mention, are you using the rest bed? Just speaking of technologies, I know Marinda is. So obviously you are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That is a, yep, that is true. I don't know when the baby comes, maybe I'll have a couple of weeks or won't be on the rest
of it. Right. That is right. Yeah. Yeah. I think getting good sleep is going to be a challenge no matter what, but I think that's another pretty powerful area just along with neurostimulation. I think sleep and hormonal regulation for athletes is like this. You know, it's sort of a common sense thing, but I think we're really talking about it now and kind of a tech like that just to help you make sure you get a little bit better sleep than you might have been. And as a recovery tool, making sure is that been working out for you? Apparently.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much emphasis on recovery, especially in our sport. And honestly, at the end of the day, sleep is the best form of recovery. I mean, that's when your body rebuilds. That's when your hormones are released. So, you know, that really needs to be a priority for everybody.
Okay. Well, guys, thanks so much for chatting with us. And Tim, good luck with the recovery. And once again, congratulations.
Thanks, TJ.
Yeah, thanks, TJ. Appreciate the time.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.